Wherever you are on your leadership voyage, it starts here.
Welcome to Leadership Voyage, the podcast dedicated to your pursuit of becoming a great leader. My name is Jason Wick, and welcome to Season 1, Episode 12. I'm so excited to get straight to the episode that let's just blast through the housekeeping. Please rate and subscribe to the Leadership Voyage podcast wherever you are listening. Check out the website at leadership.voyage and email me at startyourvoyage@gmail.com. I'm really happy to present episode 12 to you because this conversation is with software engineer and author Emmy Nietfeld. Biography and the proper spelling of her name in the show notes. Emmy is the author of the memoir Acceptance. A former foster youth, she graduated from Harvard in 2015 and worked as a software engineer at Google and Facebook. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Vice, and Slate, as well as other publications. And she lives in New York City with her family. This is not an episode like any previous one in this initial season of Leadership Voyage. Emmy is a delight to speak with, introspective, insightful, and just has some really wonderful things in this conversation. And we touch on a lot of different topics in this conversation. Some that you'll find interesting are dealing with adversity, the power of writing, goal setting, and the difference between winning as an individual versus winning as a team. So set aside 30 minutes, sit back and relax, and enjoy this wonderful conversation with Emmy Nietfeld. All right, I am here for another episode of Leadership Voyage with the author of Acceptance, Emmy Nietfeld. It's great to see you, Emmy.
Great to have me. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you bet. So you wrote this book just a couple of months ago called Acceptance, and it's a memoir focusing primarily on your high school and university years. And what I was hoping to do is start off with a juxtaposition via storytelling for the listeners, for those who have not read the book yet. So here are a list of accomplishments for you. You're accepted into college after only a couple of years of high school. You opted not to go then, but you were accepted. You got an SAT score over 2100. You attended a prestigious arts boarding school in Interlochen in Michigan. Won a national writing competition. Attended Harvard, were a collegiate rowing champion, which I love. And coming out of college, you had the challenge of deciding which tech company was going to pay you $200,000. So just reading those accomplishments for a second, I want to let everyone let that sink in. And then here is the parallel story from your book. You were sexually assaulted at 12. Your parents separated and were divorced when you were pretty young. Your birth father came out as trans and became Michelle. Michelle wasn't involved in your life, really. You were suicidal, had a hoarding mother, were in foster care, kicked out of foster care. Many summers in your high school and college years, you had nowhere to go. You were homeless. And in the summer after your senior year in high school, you were raped in Europe. Now, I bring all this up. I'm not even sure why the two parallels matter, but I found it really an interesting and dissonant description. And what I was curious was, when you think of the arc of your life during those times, what effect did adversity have on you?
That's a great question. As you're asking it, I feel this impulse, right, to turn to the narrative that is so familiar of like, you know, the adversity made me stronger. It made me who I am. It made all of the good things possible. But as I write about an acceptance, that does not ring true to me, really, for my life. And while there certainly were hardships that galvanized me, there were a lot of other ones that I feel limited my potential. And, you know, I feel very grateful that a lot of really great things happened for me. yet that doesn't erase some of the bad things.
Yeah, thanks for that answer. At least in America, we're a big fan, aren't we, of the overcoming adversity story.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I think that there's this almost knee-jerk reaction when you see someone who tells you, you know, these things happened to me that were not good, that hurt me. There's almost this knee-jerk reaction to give a silver lining, right? Mm. And I've had this at work, you know, with people who cared about me, who thought that I was talented and were mentoring me. And something that I'm working a lot on is how do we acknowledge the impact that injustice has on someone's life and take that seriously without thinking about that individual as broken? And how do we just sit with people who are going through hard things?
A lot of times we want to help, or we want to, as you're saying, put the silver lining in, but sometimes we just need to sit there and sit with them. But thank you for saying that. Now, on this podcast, we've been talking a lot about leadership. And frankly, a lot of these discussions really are specific to, you know, business community management and things like that. I've been following you for a few years and your tiny letter that you publish. And honestly, I don't even remember exactly what the inciting incident was that I learned about you. but I wanted to talk a little bit about the process of writing the book before we kind of maybe pivot to some other things that maybe are a little more directly applicable for most of the listeners. But regardless, I don't care because I'm really interested in your story. but I was thinking about, you know, if I understand correctly, Emmy, you spent 7 years or so writing this memoir, and it made me thinking about the notion of experience versus memory. We go through something at the time, and then we look back on what our recollection is of it. And those aren't always the same. So you do a great job at the end of the book detailing some of the processes that you went through to keep track of, you know, get as close as you can to being really, really accurate. And I'm wondering, you know, you have a voice when you are writing, different voices perhaps while you're writing. How did the two things compare? The perspective of the girl and woman who was going through this, and the person writing the book later on, looking at it and having it edited and things like that.
When I started writing the book just after I graduated college 7 years ago, I think it was much closer to my perspective at the time of the events. I wrote it, it was in past tense, but it was very close to like what I had been thinking and experiencing. And I would say the biggest difference there between that and the final product is kind of this context. And so I grew up in these situations. I was in a locked facility for troubled teenagers. I was in foster care, homeless for a while. And one of the defining characteristics of those experiences was having no context, feeling like I am the only person that this has ever happened to. And it's happening because of me and something about myself. And I actually didn't even realize that that wasn't true until after I had written several drafts and was showing it to other people. And so I think that providing context is something that often like parents do, teachers do, leaders in whatever ways, they help situate the individual inside their world so that they can better understand what outside forces are affecting them.
Thanks for adding that. Yeah, you sure you bring a lot of information to the table in this book about your experience, and that is really interesting to hear you say that as you're experiencing it without context. Do you think that was a common experience for the other kids that were going through some of the same things you were, that you were exposed to?
Definitely. Even when I was in environments that had other kids, like the residential treatment center, right? There were 10 of us on this unit, you know, living together, like in, you know, small white bedrooms with nothing in them. We were pretty much prohibited from talking about it. And that type of silence is one way that you can have control over people, right? By not, you know, you don't understand the larger environment. And so like, I had no idea that, for example, I had rights. I write about this at the end of Acceptance, where I was like so startled to have this idea of like, oh, like I had rights. Like, what were those rights? Like, what is a right?
Right. Right.
Right. And so I think that that's pretty, I think that that's pretty standard, but it's not something that people often think about, right? Like you think, because you have these visions in your head usually of like, what is a foster child? Like, what is a homeless person or an unhoused person going through? And of course, those stereotypes don't match up every person's life or even any one individual's life.
Yeah, of course. So from an early age, you, at least in the book, which starts, I think maybe where you're around 13 or so, 14, somewhere in there, right? You're into writing. You're really into writing. One of my favorite parts in the book was, I might be wrong here, so I apologize. It's like, November is National Writing blah, blah, blah month, and I'm going to write 50,000 words. And I started thinking about how long it might take me to write 50,000 words. And it was a little mind blowing. So you're into writing. You have some other career tracks that you end up on, which we'll get to in a little bit. But you say in the book that, boy, if I can be a good writer, or if my writing is read, maybe some other people will actually take me seriously or listen to what I'm trying to say. And I'm curious, why is this medium, why is writing powerful in your mind?
I think writing is powerful because it comes from that same place of communication that all relationships stem from. And so for me, it wasn't even about writing as a particular art form compared to other art forms, as much as just the only way of communicating that felt really accessible to me. And so I wrote about how, you know, I was taken to these doctors by my mom when I was 11, 12, 13, 14. And I tried to tell them, like, this is what's going on at home. My mom was a hoarder. We had piles of stuff covering every surface, waist high, with just narrow paths between them, rodents, often no hot water or shower. And they were not listening to me. And I think I sensed that they weren't listening to me because my mom was white, college educated. She owned a home and had full custody of me. And she was really like believable. And I was like a dirty kid who had mental health problems. So like they weren't going to trust me. And I sensed that writing was my way to convince people that they should listen to me, even when what I had to say was inconvenient or unflattering to the adults in power. And I think that's the reason so many people are writing or communicating. Like, we just want to be heard and have our reality heard.
Because there are a lot of reasons why we go through the process of writing something. Now, of course, this book is a deeply personal recollection, but you know, in business, we use chat and direct message all the time because it's efficient. Right. You can lose certain things in that without having tone, without having hearing the words and things like that. But it's interesting. As someone who has been writing for a long, long time, and you, it's really interesting to hear the emphasis on a way to be heard. I kind of like that. I'm imagining this like, oh yeah, well, you don't like what I'm saying. You're just covering your ears. Well, here it is. It's on paper. It's not going away. Right? It's right here. It's this, you can't make, you're going to rip it up. I'm going to write it again. It's real, right? You become an engineer, software engineer, and of course you're an author and whatever other labels, I don't know, that we want to put on ourselves. My question, I'm curious as we go here, is the first guest I had on this podcast is someone who has done a lot of different things. He has played in... He was a unicycling trombonist in a Broadway show, he's an author and all these other things. He said in that discussion, you know, you can be more than one thing. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that. A lot of times we have labels for each other or for ourselves, and you're someone here who is participating in multiple activities out there. And I'm curious, do you have thoughts on you can be more than one thing, or that mindset.
I love that mindset. And I definitely struggled with this as a writer and then author, because I do think we live in a culture where we really value people who give 100% to one thing. And it's like, if, you know, your work is supposed to be your passion, you know, your job where you make money is supposed to be your passion. And if you're not somehow monetizing what you love, like, you are a failure. And I also think some of this comes from classism, right? Where, especially in the writing world, where there's this idea of like the poor artist who like usually isn't actually poor, but is living below their family's standard of living.
Okay.
And so I really felt like, okay, can I be a real writer if I'm working at Google instead of like living in a house with a bunch of roommates in Iowa, like attending graduate school, right?
Yeah.
Assuming, you know, and so I think that that's something that I definitely struggled with, to give myself that legitimacy, right? Of not just like I can dabble in multiple things, but I can be good at multiple things and really be a full writer while I was also a full software engineer.
Yeah, love it. And, you know, I'm going to go on a limb and say that doing both of those things probably enhances that each other one. I'm not saying that very well.
Definitely.
The guy I referred to, the first guest on this show, he was a manager at the Apple Store. Okay. The since departed John Hughes of Breakfast Club and other films walked into the Apple Store and they talked about writing. The guest I had, he told John Hughes, "I want to be a writer." And so John Hughes said, "Well, do you write?" And of course he said, "Yes." He said, "Then you're a writer." You're right. There are these like artificial goalposts, or you can only be one thing. That's really interesting. Now, in the first two thirds of this book, Emmy, you are looking at getting into Columbia and then Yale and then Harvard, and you do succeed, right? You get into Harvard, and you are really, really focused from a young age on meeting this goal of whichever the institution it is you need to get into. Adults around you are saying, "Hey, chill. Like, have some fun," right? And you're focused. You're focused on this goal. And later on, you're at Harvard, and you're focused on, if I read it correctly, I need to get a high-paying job. There's this, I'm unlocking, you know, there's a key here that this will unlock the door. And that's your goal coming out of college. Now, if I understand your perspective correctly from the book during a lot of these times, reaching these goals is really the element in your mind that is necessary. Like, it's sometimes binary. My life is over, or it's going to go really well. I'm wondering, in the general sense, what do you think about goal setting? You know, how important is goal setting to someone? Should it be, excuse me, to someone in your estimation?
That's a great question. And I think the particular answer to that does depend a lot on the specific circumstances of someone's life. And so for me, these were goals and they were also fantasies. And so people, you know, my foster parents, they love to tell me, like, you know, "Why don't you just watch TV with us? Why are you so preoccupied with like getting A's in school?" And I was like, "Do you really expect me to be having a fun time here in foster care, like watching Deal or No Deal with these strangers?" Like, I was like, it was more enjoyable for me to go into my head and to be on this path, like the yellow brick road, like out of Minnesota to New York City. And
nothing
so,
against Minnesota, of course.
No, nothing. I appreciate it now, right? When it smells like garbage here. So for me, it was absolutely vital. And I think for a lot of young people who have, you know, almost all kids, they have limited control over their lives.
Yeah.
And so looking back, the thing that I wish is that adults had taken those goals and dreams a lot more seriously. Because I think it can be destructive to set too many goals or to rely too much on the future without looking at the present. And a goal can also be an organizing principle in somebody's life. And so when adults were talking about, you know, mental health stuff, they only thought about it in terms of like, okay, what is Emmy doing today? Like, is Emmy hurting herself? Is Emmy throwing up? And when I thought about mental health stuff, I was thinking about, okay, what is my life going to look like? What is my future going to look like? Am I going to be in an environment where I feel like I can be myself and be happy and have the resources that I need? And so for me, like reaching those goals was synonymous in some way with mental health.
Thanks for that explanation. Yeah. And I mean, as you said earlier on, a lot of kids in the situations that you were in without don't have the context. And I think not similar at all, but context for your goals, I think, of course, is really important, right? But this idea of weighing the future against what you're currently experiencing really resonates. Let's get to the rowing portion of the discussion. Now, actually, if you don't mind, Emmy, could you give us, tell us the story around how you got involved in rowing? I think people might, I don't know how in depth you'll get, but they might get a kick out of how you first got involved in collegiate rowing.
Yeah. So I grew up very unathletic. Both of my parents were older and had health issues. And so I was, you know, the least athletic person you would probably ever meet. And so when I got to college, I was suddenly surrounded by all these like people who exercised. I was like, what's that? And so I started jogging and stuff like that, but I was really intrigued by the rowers. And so next to Harvard is the Charles River and just this picturesque, you know, bridges and stuff over it and boats. And in these boats, there were these like grunting tall people, like led by like a really small yelling person.
Hey, I can be a grunting tall person, you're thinking, right?
Yeah, I was, well, yeah, a little bit. And I both thought, okay, I could be a grunting tall person. I'm 5'10". And I thought, you know, I could never do that because it's for preppy people with upper body strength. And so my junior year, I was selected to be a teaching assistant for the introduction to computer science class. But the people who did this, they had to work a lot. The pay wasn't very good. And at the same time, I learned that a rowing boat costs like $50,000. And if you were a varsity athlete, you could use it for free. Okay. And I was like, that sounds like a better deal to me than this teaching assistant stuff. So I, as a junior, walked onto the rowing team and I found that I actually was pretty good at it because I believed that I could suffer more than just about anyone.
Believed you could suffer more than just about anyone. What a fascinating thing to say. And you end up in the book, you end up in some type of match against Yale and you win some type of championship. I apologize. I don't remember what specifically it was. I found it a little ironic too, or poignant maybe, just because you're beating Yale, which is where you really wanted to go before Harvard. But nonetheless, this is one of the most beautifully crafted scenes I've read in a long time. You're everybody go out there and get acceptance, please, because you're a part of a team here and you're recounting this scene where the, is it coxswain? Is that the right way to say it?
Coxswain, which doesn't make any sense. It's a coxswain. Yeah.
Well, it's for preppy people. So it has to be hard. So the coxswain is guiding the rest of the rowers and your crew. Right. And it's like, they're yelling out the name of each person on the team, you know, give me 5 rows for whoever and give me 7 for Emmy. And you're enduring, you're suffering. I mean, you can barely see, if I recall, at this point. And your team perseveres and wins the match. And I wrote the note here to you, but I was in tears at this point in the book. It was just a spectacular way to recount the situation, and I adored it. What I am really interested in is so much of the focus we've talked about on your goal setting and elsewhere is about you. What's the difference between winning something for yourself and going through an experience like this where you're a part of a team?
That's a great question. I write about in acceptance how after I got into Harvard, I actually was pretty depressed. And I had a few other things that spring, like when I won this national writing contest and I found out and I just reacted with tears and not necessarily tears of joy, but I was like, I'm supposed to feel happier than I do today. Now I know that post-achievement depression is a real thing and is very common, but I was 17. I had no idea. I thought that I was just going to be miserable for the rest of my life. And so my experience of individual success has involved a lot of loneliness. I think when it's just you, after the goal is achieved, for me, it's always been like a so then what, right? Mm-hmm. And because my life has been so driven by these like big giant goals, that has been a lot of like big letdowns. And so for me, being on this team was really wonderful in part because I could experience how sometimes it's easier to push yourself for someone else than for you. And I felt like my life had kind of forced me to be selfish in certain ways. Okay. And I don't mean that to dunk on myself, but I was so preoccupied with my own survival and my own upward mobility that I had never really gotten to have that where like I want to do a good job for this other person, right? And for us as a team. And so that's definitely something that I now value so much, having a team that I care about, whether it was at Google, I really loved the people I was working with and my manager, and I wanted our projects to succeed for us.
Yeah.
And now with the publishing process, you know, I have an amazing relationship with my editor. And, you know, when things haven't gone exactly how I've wanted, I feel more like I wish I could have done this for my editor than even about myself. Okay. And I think for me, it's a huge relief to be able to like think that way.
Interesting evolution. Yeah.
Yeah.
And thanks for those examples too. I really do like the one where your editor, you know, those of us who have never published a book, which is probably most of us listening, you know, it's like the thought of the editor as your teammate. I guess I just wouldn't have naturally thought of that. And I guess I would have thought of it more as a gatekeeper. So that's really cool to hear, wanting success and wanting things for that teammate. Also, as a reader of the book, going to Harvard and or elsewhere, Interlaken in Michigan, a very prestigious arts high school, a boarding school, you were looking to belong, right? And a team obviously can help with belonging, or it should help with belonging. And it seems that you reached that, and you have reached that in different contexts. You do get the job at Google, and some of the early descriptions you provide of being exposed to the culture at Google, it seems like you're really overcome in a positive way that, wow, people are thinking about all the different things in my life that I might need. They're anticipating how they can support me as an employee. It's almost like this job or the company, it's like a family or something in that sense. And yet, I don't want to bring the conversation down, but here's the reality is a year ago, you ended up penning an opinion piece in the New York Times. And the title is, "After working at Google, I'll never let myself love a job again." Now, I don't really feel the need to pry on details or find juicy tidbits here. The point is, you chronicle some basic points about going through harassment at Google and what the experience was like for you as an employee. And you worked there for 4 years. What I am really interested in hearing from you, and I'm sure others will find interested as well, is how should the relationship between an employee and a company look in your mind?
Whoa, that's a big question. You didn't put that in the list of things you were going to send me, you were going to ask me. So in that piece, I write about how when I came to Google, it felt like finding a home. And I think I write about this in even more detail in Acceptance, about how I had been searching for this place that I was going to belong, where I was going to find my people. I was going to have safety and security and be taken care of, and how so many of the benefits and amenities and even the culture at Google really made me feel this sense of being in a family, right? Which a lot of companies liked to call themselves, still do. And when I experienced harassment from my mentor and ended up reporting it, what was so devastating to me was that Google was an institution, just like these other institutions I had passed through, and that the company was going to protect itself first. You know, and I think a big part of what I explored in that article was really the process of growing up, where at first, you know, you're idealistic and you believe like a company can transcend all of the incentives that are kind of there from the law and business and money. And I think that's part of why this piece resonated with a lot of people, because I think virtually everybody has walked into a situation like thinking it was going to be like heaven on earth and then crash down to reality.
Yeah.
I think for me, the pieces that were damaging and avoidable were the parts that really felt like gaslighting. I experienced this, and I know lots of other people experienced it because it was in the news, that when people were reporting harassment and discrimination, at least to a certain number of them, Google would suggest, you know, you need therapy, and would refer them to the on-site counseling program, which for some people ended up having its own issues. You know, I think that was the part that was, I think, totally avoidable, right? And after I left Google, I went to another company where, you know, all of tech kind of has this problem of gender imbalance, also racial imbalance for sure. And, but they didn't have the same kind of like marketing of like, oh, we're better than everyone else. Okay. I got there and I just kind of was like, okay, this is the way that it is. And it actually felt better to me to be like, nobody's like lying to me, right?
So almost the expectations of what you're arriving at or where you're starting to work is almost setting it up in a way for.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And I think that it's often engineered to be that way. Right. And people say like, you know, they give you these benefits at these big tech companies because they want you to work like crazy hours. And for me, for like the people I saw at Google, there were not that many people working insane hours, at least not compared to like banking or even being like a home health worker, right? Or an Uber driver, retail worker, right? Like those people are working way more hours than any white collar professionals I saw at Google. But I do think that those benefits really made it so that my life was tied up with this company. And so that leaving meant not just leaving a job, but leaving a whole lifestyle and a whole like community, really.
We're sitting here in September of 2022. And yeah, I mean, it's just kind of this ongoing discussion about what does an employee owe a company? What does a company owe an employee? The catchphrase of the month has been quiet quitting. You know, I don't even know if we all agree on what that means. But yeah, I appreciate you sharing your experience and your just kind of your thoughts. You know, it's the systems that are in place, right? You can't ignore the systems, right? Everybody has their individual experience, but the systems are in place. And there's a big factor in everybody's, the dynamic that they have with work and with their company. So
definitely. And I hope in acceptance that one of my big goals was to show how some of the fundamental institutions of American life, like college admissions and the way that, you know, we think about children's rights, parents' rights, how those all like affect our lives on a day to day, like decision by decision, like goal by goal level.
Yeah. Thank you. My question that I ask everybody near the end is, you know, what is something related to this or not, our topics or not? What's something that you've learned recently?
Actually, this morning, I read a study that showed that living in poverty was equivalent, like it had the equivalent like cognitive load of losing 13 IQ points.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And that really resonated with me with, you know, there's been a lot of talk about like learning loss with COVID and how do we help kids like get back on track? But I also saw that in 2021, apparently the child poverty rate in the United States was cut in half. Yeah, probably largely because of the because of like cash payments to parents.
No kidding.
Okay. As part of COVID relief. Yeah. Isn't that cool? So it's like, on one hand, a lot was lost. And on the other hand, that was great, great progress on the child poverty front.
Wow.
So,
well, thanks for sharing that. That's great.
Yeah.
So for those of you interested in the book or anything else that you want to share, where should people go? Where would you like to direct them?
So you can find links to buy Acceptance at emmyneetfeld.com, my first name, last name. And I'm on social media, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn at Emmy Neetfeld as well. And I have a newsletter, which you'll find on my website, which Jason Wick is already a fan of, our host. So
yes, I am.
I hope that other people will enjoy it too.
That's great. Well, Emmy, thanks for putting some time aside today. I really, really enjoyed talking about all of this with you and your wisdom and experience, your insights. I know many people are going to benefit from reading the book and from hearing your thoughts. So thanks for being gracious with your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Jason.